Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining this call. Yesterday evening, we announced the anticipation of an impairment to part of our U.S. portfolio on the back of a pre-FID review of our near-term U.S. offshore development projects. As a part of this review, we have assessed the aggregate adverse impacts relating to our supply chain developments, lack of favorable progress on our ITC guidance, and interest rates increasing. Let me walk you through each of the respective developments. On the supply chain challenges, we have seen several impacts by a handful of supplier delays materializing over the recent weeks, which relate to our Ocean Wind 1, Sunrise, and Revolution Wind projects. As there is an inherent risk associated with our project schedules, we constantly monitor these risks across all our projects and ensure that we take the most impactful steps in mitigating those. In recent weeks, we have seen an increasing probability that some risks will materialize, leading us to reflect this in our business cases. Specifically, the adverse impacts relate to our foundation supplier for Ocean Wind 1, EEW, that is experiencing challenges in the production of foundation. This means that we now expect a COD early 2026 of Ocean Wind 1. For our northeastern projects, Sunrise Wind and Revolution Wind, the project's foundation supplier, BLAS, is also experiencing ramp-up and transportation challenges. Finally, we've seen an increasing likelihood of risks materializing around the timing of our Charybdis vessel, as well as greater visibility on the costs to mitigate these. It remains our expectations that we will utilize the Charybdis vessel for at least part of the installation of our northeastern projects. While working on several mitigating actions, we have concluded that there is a continuously increasing risk in these suppliers' ability to deliver on their commitments and contracted schedules. This could create knock-on effects requiring future remobilizations to finish installation, as well as potential delayed revenue, extra costs, and other business case implications. Our current assessment is that the impact from these developments can lead to impairments of up to 5 billion DKK. However, we continue to work on all mitigating actions that can reduce these impacts. In addition, our continued discussions with senior federal stakeholders about additional ITC qualifications for Ocean Wind 1 and Sunrise Wind are not progressing as we had previously expected. We continue to engage in discussions with federal stakeholders to qualify for additional tax credits beyond 30%. If these efforts prove unsuccessful, it could lead to impairments of up to 6 billion DKK. The level of a possible impairment would be decided based on a probability-weighted assessment of the likelihood of obtaining the additional ITCs. Finally, the U.S. long-dated interest rates have increased, which affects our U.S. offshore projects and certain onshore projects. If the interest rates remain at the current level by the end of third quarter, it will cause an impairment of approximately 5 billion DKK. The above factors cause deterioration of the business cases, which is, of course, very unsatisfactory. As we previously communicated, the near-term U.S. offshore wind development projects do not meet our value creation target on a life cycle basis. However, we remain convinced that as additional investments that we will be deploying into the portfolio would be within our 150-300 basis point spread to WACC target on a forward-looking basis, we will continue to mature the projects while working on all levers that can contribute to the value creation. Pending boundary conditions such as tax credit clarity and local permits, we will work towards a final investment decision for the projects either by the end of the year or early next year. Let me be clear that we will continue to carefully assess all of our options related to our awarded U.S. projects to ensure that we make the most financially responsible decisions. As we communicated earlier, we are willing to walk away from projects if we do not see value creation that meet our criteria. To ensure that we will not end up in a similar situation, we will ensure that we have significantly improved project visibility, which, amongst other, will be enabled by the development of our first wave of projects. This is already reflected in our approach towards the remainder of our U.S. awarded portfolio, where we have decided to reconfigure our Skipjack and Ocean Wind 2 projects, as they currently do not meet our value creation criteria. Similarly, our recent and future bids in the U.S. ensure that we can mitigate some of the risks that our awarded portfolio have encountered in terms of cost inflation, as this will be adjusted through inflation-adjusting mechanisms in the offtake price. Adjusted for the anticipated impairments, our average ROCE for the period 2023 through 2030 will remain around 14%. Other ambitions and financial targets remain unchanged. And with this, let's open up to questions for myself, our Group CFO, Daniel Leo, and the CEO of our Region Americas, David Hardy. Operator, please.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you can press star followed by one on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to remove your question, you may press star followed by two. Please ensure you're unmuted locally when asking your question. Our first question for today comes from Harry Wyburd of BNP Paribas. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Hi, morning everyone. It's Harry Wyburd from Exane. I'll stick to the usual one question, so presumably there'll be many others. Can I just start by asking which of your CMD's financial targets for the long term, so up to 2030, remain valid and which ones are effectively being modified by this announcement? And specifically, on the ROCE guidance, if I understand correctly, you've reflected the write-down in lower capital employed. So presumably that implies a long-term EBIT downgrade. And I wondered if you could quantify that EBIT downgrade and also help us understand whether it's just driven by the EBIT impact of lower ITC assumptions, because I understand that the ITCs come through EBIT, or whether there's something else implying a lower EBIT as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Harry. So it is only our long-term ROCE target that will be impacted by the impairment. And as we also outlined in the company announcement, there is, of course, still uncertainty as to how that impairment will turn out. Specifically very much due to the ITCs, where there's still uncertainty whether we'll get the 30% or 40% on Ocean Wind 1 and Sunrise. So of course the ROCE will depend on the size of the impairment. But are we in a scenario where, let's say, we do not get the ITCs, so it's the roughly 10 billion impairment that plays out, the long-term ROCE, so the average up until 2030, will be impacted by roughly 1 percentage point. So that's going from the around 14 to 13. So we are still committed to delivering on those roughly 14% ROCE, however adjusted for the amount of the impairment. And you are correct that the ITCs will be going through the EBITDA and EBIT.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, just to clarify, so the 1% difference you mentioned, the 14 to 13, is that saying on the current level of capital employed pre-impairment, we're looking at a 14 to 13% decline, and therefore you could sort of apply that roughly to EBIT as the delta. Have I understood that right?
No, so it's basically just the impact of the impairment this year, the size of that impacting the average ROCE is roughly the 1 percentage point impact.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Alberto Gandolfi from Goldman Sachs. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my question. I'll also stick to the one rule. It's a question of two parts. What has changed in the past couple of months since the CMD? Why do you see now things worsening that you couldn't have seen back then? And, you know, at the CMD, you said those projects in the U.S. are not particularly, well, do not create value. They are NPV neutral, I think you used as a terminology. But you also said from now on, given the capex we have already spent, we better continue and go ahead because they have an NPV positive if we look at what is left to spend. Now, given the picture you just painted on supply chain, on delays, on cost, on interest rates, I guess the question is, but if you don't mind, I would love you to touch on the points I made. Why don't you just walk away if things are getting worse? Why don't you just walk away if you don't get an incremental 10 percentage points? Your stock is not pricing in future growth. We continue to have negative news on the offshore industry. Why not playing a bit more hardball with the policymakers if you don't get the 10% IDC? So I guess the big question, why not walking away? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Alberto. Let me take the sort of the two-in-one question. So what is it that actually has changed the CMD since the CMD? Because we actually said that there was a sort of there were known costs in our contract, which is actually still true. So the implications, the adverse implications we see are not they are about the delays and the impacts of those delays. So essentially not something that was outstanding to negotiate at the point of time where we had the CMD. And we are still in a situation where the forward-looking is still for the portfolio within the 150 to 300 guided range on a forward-looking basis. And this is where it is tempting to say, couldn't we just walk away? But as we already shared at the point of time of the CMD, the level of sunk cost just means that it is the financially rational decision to stay in these projects. Where we clearly said it is the exception to the rule. These projects that have already suffered from significant delays from the previous administration in the U.S., we said they are going to be positive within the guided range on a forward-looking basis. Still the case, and even with the current assumptions of that we mentioned in terms of potential impairments, that is still the case. But we are putting maximum pressure on the federal stakeholders to ensure that we get the support needed to avoid some of these impairments. So walking away would not still not be the best and most responsible ways for our shareholders' money.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Deepa Venkateswaran of Bernstein. Deepa, your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I have a similar question on what's changed, which is on the negotiations with the federal agencies. So we know that at the CMD there was a draft and you were confident of moving it along in the right direction. So can you tell us what's happened in the meantime in your negotiations? And secondly, I know you've also separately applied for a PPA renegotiation for Sunrise Wind in New York. Is there any assessment of how that's going? Is there any quantification of that that's included? I think not. If not, could you also highlight if you were not to get that, I think almost 27 or 29% escalation, then what's the additional impairment we could be looking at? Thank you.
Hi, Deepa. Thanks for the question. This is David. To follow up on your question, at the time of the CMD, we highlighted a handful of things that were in our assumptions. One was the path back in New Jersey, which thankfully we successfully achieved. The other one was the renegotiation with the state of New York for Sunrise, which you mentioned. I would say that that process is still in motion. We're hoping to get resolution on that in the October-November timeframe, but based on a lot of comments, the comment period is closed for feedback from stakeholders just this week. And based on those comments, it seems like we have a lot of support for getting some support there. So we include in our current assumptions a fairly high probability that we'll still be able to get that OREC adjustment on the Sunrise Wind project. Obviously, there's some risk that might not happen, and then that would change our assessment. But as it stands today, we still feel very confident about that one. Then the part that maybe is hard to explain is at the time we said that we assumed 40% ITC across our portfolio of those three projects, near-term projects. Right now we have high confidence that Revolution will achieve 40%. For Sunrise and Ocean Wind 1, I guess there hasn't been a strong catalyst per se that's giving us less doubt, but there's not enough progress to give us more confidence. And as these supply chain issues became a catalyst for us wanting to be more transparent with you about challenges on our project, we also took the opportunity to highlight the most recent interest rate changes and the lack of progress on the ITCs. But as Matt said, we are still exerting a lot of pressure. We're still highlighting to federal stakeholders and others the need for better guidance that supports these projects and the industry overall. And I would say that just the lack of progress has caused us to slightly decrease our confidence in getting the ITCs, and we just showed the full range in this company announcement. But then, it depends on how things play out over the next months, if we actually take that impairment or not.
So just a follow-up. So the $6 billion is the maximum for ITC. What you might end up taking will be a probability-weighted adjustment if you think that the so is $6 billion the maximum, or is $6 billion what you're more likely to take?
Yeah, it's a maximum. That is, if we do not get anything beyond the current 30% for Revolution and Ocean Wind 1 deepness. So if we get for one of them, it would be a lower number, and if we get for both, it would be significantly lower.
And just one more comment. We're obviously trying, to influence both the different options, the two different 10% adders, both energy communities and domestic content. So there's a parallel path to see if we can find a way to get at least 40% on all three of these projects.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Christian Johansson of SEB. Christian, your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. So just getting back to the renegotiation on the OREC with the state of New York. So as I recall it, you obviously did the impairment on Sunrise Wind earlier. So as I recall it, if you actually were able to get this renegotiation, you would have to reverse that impairment. So can you just talk us through the potential financial implication if you get it, and if you don't, what will it trigger in terms of reversals or impairments?
Yeah, so this is an ongoing dialogue with the state of New York. So we can't be too specific on the numbers here, but we are in our impairment assessments putting a probability weighted assumption into us making or getting an OREC adjustment. So there's both an upside and a downside in the impairment on Sunrise, depending on how the final adjustment will be looking like.
Okay, that makes sense. And then just second question here on Revolution Wind. Why are you so confident that you can get the 40% ITC for Revolution Wind, but not for the two others?
Yeah, this is David again. The remember, there's two different ways you can qualify for extra 10%. One is domestic content, which, as the current guidance is written, no short-term, near-term projects, ours or anyone else's, will qualify. That's why we are in discussion with the administrators and federal stakeholders to try to explain that if they want to develop the offshore wind industry and the offshore wind supply chain, you can't put requirements that no one can meet. But the second way to qualify is through this concept called an energy community. And there's, you know, preliminary guidance around what the definition of an energy community is. And basically, Revolution Wind qualifies based on that preliminary definition. So we have, you know, high confidence that when the final definition of energy communities comes out, if it's not significantly different than what it is today, we would qualify. But we are trying to expand the definition of energy communities to potentially help other projects qualify.
Understood. Very clear. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dominic Nash of Barclays. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much. Question for me, how much invested capital do you have in the US both before and after this write-down? And secondly, could you give us some sensitivity to changes in the interest rate on the write-down impairment level, please? Thank you.
Yes, thank you for the question. So we have invested roughly $4 billion USD into the US offshore portfolio. And that it is that base we will be making the impairment on. When it comes to interest rate sensitivity, what we are indicating now with the company announcement is that if rate stays at the current level, it will impact with roughly 5 billion DKK, and that is based on a roughly 50 bps increase in US rates, long-term rates, since the end of Q2. So I think that gives you an indication of the rate sensitivity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lars Heindorf of Nordea. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Yes, morning. Thank you for taking my questions. It's regarding the delays in the supply chain. Just a question on, are there any, you mentioned the foundation and also the supply vessel, are there any issues related to the turbine manufacturers? That's the first one. And secondly, which onshore projects is it that are affected by these delays as well?
Thank you, Lars. I can take the first one. No, there are no issues relating to the turbine supplies. It is, by far the majority, it is an implication and the potential delay implications of the foundation manufacturers and then the mitigation costs that we are now clear on of the delays in the installation vessel.
Which onshore?
Yeah, so on the onshore side, it's spread across a number of assets, and it's only driven by the interest rate changes that we've seen. And it's a handful of onshore wind assets that are being impacted to the tune of roughly 1 billion DKK out of the 5 billion that we indicate on the rate impact.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ahmed Farman of Jefferies. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my question. Can I just actually come back to the longer-term EBIT target? So could you just sort of talk us through again, how does the sort of the announcement overnight impacts the longer-term EBITDA 27 and 2030 EBITDA targets? And give us some sensitivity if you're unable to get the additional ITC credits, what would be the sensitivity around the longer-term EBITDA targets? Thank you.
Yeah, so our expectation is that despite the fact that you will potentially see a lower earnings in the EBITDA longer term from a lower assumptions on the ITCs. We will still be able to, you can say, capture that uncertainty within our guided EBITDA growth towards 2030. So the 13% to 14% growth.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jenny Ping of Citi. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. So just to understand what we're expecting to see at the 3Q results. So effectively, you're saying the supply chain issue, 5 billion, that's pretty much going to be charged in 3Q. 6 billion ITCs, maybe a bit lower depending on how the negotiations goes. And then the further 5 billion is also going to go through. Is that the correct understanding? Thank you.
Yeah, what we put out is essentially the up to, and I think the we've written up to 5 billion on supply chain issues. And that is where, of course, we are mobilizing everything we can to mitigate and lower those impacts. But with our current knowledge, that is the maximum number that we're looking at. So we are flagging that up to range. In terms of interest rates, it's more mechanical. So if they stay at the current level, that's the rough impact of the 5 billion. The biggest uncertainty, and also where we will with some likelihood end at a lower number, is on the ITC implications, where we're just flagging the range that if we get nothing in this time and have 0% outlook of that happening when we come to end of Q3, then this could be up to 6 billion. But in reality, as we also write in the company announcement, this will be probability weighted if we don't have an outcome on that, and therefore it's very likely that it will be a different and lower number than that. That's how you should look at it.
Okay, and just to follow up on rates, I guess as you say, it's mechanical, and it presumably would work the other way. If we, for whatever reason, continue to see rates go up, there's risk of further impairments just on that basis.
Yes, that's correctly understood. And for impairment purposes, we are using spot rates. So it's going to be quarter to quarter for the assets that are impaired. You know, more mark to market approach on the interest rates.
Would you be able to share some sort of sensitivity around the rates impact on how you test?
Yeah, so what you are seeing, the impairment that we are talking about now from the rates, the 5 billion DKK, that is basically driven by the fact that we've seen long-dated U.S. rates go up with 50 bips since the end of Q2. So that gives you a good indication of the sensitivity that should rates go up with further 50 bips, you will roughly be in that 5 billion magnitude. If it goes 50 bits down, we will be able to not take that 5 billion impairment.
Okay, that's really clear. And sorry, one last one. What bond yield are you using? Is it the 10-year or the 30-year?
We don't want to specify specifically what yield we use because we think it's a sensitive topic, what we put into our WACC, which is of course a key driver going into auction and tenders, but it is a long-dated U.S. Government yield that we assume with our risk-free interest rate.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dan Togo of Carnegie. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Just a question on what are the possibilities for you to recover any of this through your suppliers in the supply chain or through merchant elements when you finally to need through selling the power at a later stage. So So what are the possibilities of recover some of this at a later stage?
Yeah, so I want to assure them that I understand the second part of your question, but on the first part, we of course do have contracts that put us in place to get some compensation from suppliers, but that is typically something that is capped at around the contract value. And unfortunately, if there is a delay like we see right now, the knock-off implications on the total project economics are greater than that. And that's also why we will of course pursue those opportunities, but the total project impact are regrettably significantly greater than the liability that our suppliers would have. And if there was a second part of that question that I didn't answer, please repeat it.
Yeah, if it's just if any of these offtake contracts or you can sell some power at a later stage, through a merchant opportunity that could impact, so to say, the project return, is there a possibility there at some point?
Yeah, I think the short answer is that is already assumed to be the case then. So that would be that would not be one of the sort of the big upsides. I think because obviously right now this is an unsatisfactory situation. So I think it is quite important also to mention that there are still upside levers, such as also and David can elaborate, cheap loan opportunities from federal channels that we could still get at, that would mean project economics could improve. We are still in process with that. As mentioned on the ITCs, we have far from given that up yet, which we give an offset to the level that we have right now. But on the overall sort of fundamental project economics, it would mainly be within mitigating the impacts of the supply chain, plus the already ongoing negotiations on OREC and ITC that would be the upsides compared to the picture we have right now.
Understood. Then just a small follow-up. Can you give us some sort of comfort in whether this is contained to the U.S. I mean, you are struggling with interest rates and supply chain, I guess, other places in the world. So are we facing similar issues elsewhere in the portfolio?
Now, the overall picture is that this is a U.S. issue. Of course, there are rate increases in other parts of the world. But we are assessing those on an ongoing basis. But we are not at a level where this is something that leads us to impairments, unless something further happens towards the end of Q3. But it is primarily a U.S. issue. And for example, the supply chain issues, they are always in offshore. There are supply chain challenges that we are generally very good at fighting. But the magnitude of what we are seeing in the U.S., because it's a completely new market, it's just significantly bigger than anywhere else.
So thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sam Arie from UBS. Sam, your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for doing this call. I think I just wanted to ask, just putting together some of the earlier questions, I think you said you had about $4 billion invested in the U.S. I'm thinking about your sort of $16 billion impairment case, which looks like a little bit more than half of that value. My question is, could you talk to us about what could be the remaining downside case, I suppose, in the scenario where the supply chain issues get worse, you have further delays, et cetera, et cetera? How would that work out? I suppose on the one hand, you might think you have to write everything down. On the other hand, you might say, well, even if you walk away from these projects, you're still going to have the possibility to do it again in future under different terms, and so there would still be some value left. So can you just help us think through what is the worst-case scenario if things were to get worse from here? And I'm focusing on the U.S., I mean, not the rest of the world. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we wouldn't be having this call if we hadn't done a whole lot of work to really take our best guess at what we think is the actual and situation that we're in. And within all these numbers, we still carry a lot of contingency. We've got probability weighting that could lead to both upside and downside, et cetera. And so I just think it's not super valuable for us to kind of speculate like how much worse it could be. You know, there's so many things that could go right, and there's obviously things that could continue to go wrong. So this is our best assessment of where things stand today. And we're working all the channels that we have, both on the project, you know, mitigation channels to try to minimize these downsides, not use all our contingencies, so that inherently creates an upside, and the levers Matt's already spoke about around ICP's price negotiation and other things. So I don't think we can give you more clarity on, you know, what, how worse could it go. I think we've been clear that we will only, you know, move forward if we have positive forward-looking value creation, and we haven't taken FID on these projects yet. So as we continue through the next, you know, 4 to 6 months continuing to understand these risks better and mitigate them and control the upside potential that we can, and we'll just try to be as transparent as we can to our shareholders and analysts, et cetera.
Okay. Listen, thank you for that. And I understand it's difficult to sort of give me another scenario, but maybe I could just one quick follow-up. Could you just help us understand, in a scenario which I think Alberto asked about earlier, where you did decide at some point you just have to walk away from some of these projects, directionally, are there additional sort of negative unwind costs that you would have to incur if you walked away from the project, or would you see some sort of floor value that you would still retain in those potential projects, assuming if you walked away from the current contracts, you might still be able to build them in the future with other contracts?
Yes. Again, as we look at the projects and we take prudent business decisions, that's obviously one of the scenarios we look at every time. Is, you know, what's the unwind cost? You know, what kind of recovery could we get in our termination cost? How could we reuse equipment? What commercial negotiations could we have with suppliers, et cetera? Is there inherent value that we could apply to a different offtake scenario, et cetera? So we really try to do a full, thorough analysis of all the potential options for the project, and we really do look at all these different scenarios. And as it stands today, we believe the best position or the best direction is to continue to invest in these projects. As you know, unfortunate as it is that we have to announce potential impairment, it still is the better choice than walking away today.
Okay, understood. Just as a comment, but it still leaves me a bit unclear how far away we are in today's announcement from the walkaway values. But I guess what you're saying is you can't disclose that. So I appreciate the comment that you did give. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Martin Tessier of Stifel. The line is now open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks. Good morning, and thank you for taking my question. Reading at the press release, cost inflation is not mentioned, but instead you mentioned project delays due to a tight supply chain, higher interest rates, and unsuccessful discussions regarding ITCs. So I was just wondering if we could see further impairments in the short to medium term due to cost inflation, because you already placed 2.5 billion DKK in February for Sunrise Wind, but the announcement from this morning mentions other projects where you have not placed any impairment regarding cost inflation yet. So can we have more clarity on this, please? Thank you.
Yes, happy to comment on that, Martin. As we already said to the CMD, that the costs of these projects in terms of the contracts, we have very high visibility to. And that also means that the likelihood of direct inflation-driven downside is low, because this is where we have already, these are advanced projects. We have uncovered these issues as part of our pre-FID work, which is very thorough, and we have actually essentially confirmed that cost and inflation picture as part of that work. And the impacts we see here are by far the largest part of this up to 5 billion is driven only by the knockoff implications of the delays. So we would say that the risk of inflation-driven future impairments or negative impact is low.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Klaus Kell of Nykredit Credit. The line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Related to this impairment of 5 billion related to the rising interest rates, what happens with this impairment if, let's say, that the interest rates stay at the current level throughout this year? And then in 24, let's just assume that interest rates drop 100 bips. Will you then start to make reversal of the impairments, or is that impossible from a accounting point of view?
No, that's correct. So we will, every time we do impairments, base it on the updated spread at the point of impairment. And if we see rates go down, we will reverse the impairments if the totality of the project has a higher forward-looking value with that specific spot rate.
Okay, so just to be clear, then you will be able to reverse any impairments if rates.
We will be able to reverse, yes, if rates go down. Correctly, correctly understood.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our final question for today is a follow-up question from Jenny Ping of Citi. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Just on the interest rate point, I'm not sure I quite understand. I haven't come across any other long-dated asset companies sort of doing write-up, write-downs on interest rate alone. So I just want to understand that point. And also, I guess the other question related to it is, what about the rest of your asset book? Interest rates have gone up across the globe. So have you been looking at, and or is there a risk of the rest of your asset book on this interest rate point? Thank you.
Yeah, so basically we need to do following accounting rules and assessment based on the spot interest rates. So we will be seeing that when a project has moved into impairment territory, it is going to be very sensitive to the development in the long-dated interest rates. And that means that headroom will be going out when the rates go up and increase when the rates go down. And when you have impaired already a project due to the rates, then if the rates go down, we are able to reverse that impairment in our books. But that is the accounting standard.
And the impact for the rest of the asset book?
So we have done the assessment of the rest of our assets, and there is no impairment outside of the U.S. But of course, as I said, when rates go up, the headroom will become smaller and smaller as we take a forward spot rate view in the impairment tests.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from David Paz of Wolfe Research. David, your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I had a clarifying question and then a separate question. is the EBITDA growth rate that you have for 27 and 2030, are those intact? I think I heard you say yes, but then I also heard you say that that could be lower. Just
Yes, they are intact.
Okay, thank you. And then just on the U.S. portfolio in general, you said $1 billion was on the onshore, $1 billion DKK was on the onshore, on select onshore projects. Did I hear that correctly? And was that just related to the interest rate potential impairment, or was that separate from the interest rate?
Yes, that's correct. Driven by the interest rate increase, roughly 1 billion DKK spread across a handful of U.S. onshore projects.
Got it. No incremental delays on the onshore businesses from your...
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Richard Alderman of BTIG. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was just wondering, given the comments you said around the outlook for the balance sheet at the Capital Markets Day, if all of what you said today comes towards a worst-case scenario, we have higher rates and possibly even a higher than 16 billion impairment, does it change your view on the need for equity for the business in the next 2 or 3 years in relation to what you said at the Capital Markets Day?
No, it does not, Richard. We have carefully assessed that, and it is still, even with these adverse impacts, a self-funded plan.
Okay, thank you. And one last question, just in relation to the comments around rates and the onshore impairment of around 1 billion DKK, how do you think about that with the rest of your onshore business elsewhere in the world? Is there any further risk that we could see impairments there based on rate moves?
The size of the onshore portfolio outside of the U.S. is at a level where it's not anything meaningful you should expect coming from that. But in principle, you could see an effect from rising interest rates also on the European onshore portfolio, but that would be to a very low amount.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Peter Bitsteger from Bank of America. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Apologies, I missed the beginning of the call, so you've probably already answered this, but have you given an updated potential timeline for Sunrise Wind and Revolution Wind? Because you mentioned Ocean Wind is now 2026. And if you don't get the 40% ITC, I presume that means Sunrise Wind and Ocean Wind can't make FID. Is that correct? So just first clarification for stuff I might have missed. And then just very quickly going back to this sort of interest rate thing, are we now, given the volatility in US rates, are we now expected to see every quarter write-downs or write-ups of your offshore portfolio value, or is there a certain threshold beyond which you'll do it? So do we need to see a 50 basis point move, or literally now is it every 10 or 15 basis points that we're going to see these changes? Thank you.
Yes, so there's a high likelihood that you will from quarter to quarter see a swing on the impairment depending on how big the cases are in the interest rate. But remember that this is of course a portfolio of projects that we are now looking at, so they might be moving in different directions every time we do the full impairment assessment. But in principle, it is very much a mechanical adjustment that we'll be doing as long as the projects are in impairment territory based on what the spot rate is at the specific quarterly announcement.
Yeah, this is David. I can take the first two questions. The first one, if I understood it, was the timeline for COD for Revolution and Sunrise. It's our expectation that we can still maintain the current project schedules. As we talked about, the Charybdis vessel and the monopile delays from Blatt could have an impact on both of those two projects, but as we see it today, we're basically on track from a project schedule standpoint. It's just creating increased costs to try to maintain the project schedule, and we're compressing some of our float in our execution schedule. And so we wouldn't necessarily change the timeline. Could be, you know, minor impacts which flow through from a time value of money of the start of revenue, but in general not significant moves. And then on FID, I think it's a really good question. You know, obviously we take the FID decision when we take it. And so going into those FID decisions, I think it will be, you know, what are the current business cases look like, especially in these cases from a forward IRR standpoint. You know, what do the risks look like? And all the other factors that we take when we take an FID. We haven't taken an FID on these three projects yet, so that'll be still to come. But it's still our expectation, and we're still trying to achieve taking FID on these three projects by the end of this year or early next year. So.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Due to time, we'll take no further questions, so I'll hand back to Mads Nipper for any further remarks.
Yes, and I just want to thank you for your questions and in a challenging situation. But thanks a lot for the dialogue, and have a safe day.